Because we have a spiritual aspect as well.
And also because, you know, we don't know the right way to do even materialistic things.
Yeah, exactly.
So, because of that, we have to, first of all, understand the level of being that we are in it.
Mm-hmm.
We have some, you know, personality, I don't know, soul or something. And we need to answer this. Without answering these kind of things, we will face a kind of deep depression in ourselves.
Exactly. So as you two both told us, I would get it like this, that in order to continue our life, in order to, because just as different things that we have in our ordinary life, we need an instruction book. Mm-hmm. As human beings, we need an instruction book, and we have to use that book in order to continue our life. And religion is that instruction book for human beings, because we have both a spiritual and physical aspect. When this idea happened, actually, it was about 16th or 17th century, that people started to think about these sort of things, that we should not consider religion in different things, like, for example, more social and economical issues. At that time, people were more primitive. They were quick to sin, quick to repent, quick to laugh, quick to cry, whatever. Everything in them was primitive. Their understanding of religion also was so much primitive. You know what they thought? They usually thought this way, that after all these, you know, that at that time, there were so much of disasters. People were going through different kind of sicknesses that got no cure. So plenty much of people were dying for nothing. One day, a kind of catastrophe would come upon you. You will feel sick, you will go through different social issues, and then you'll die. That's the end of the story. So religion has done them nothing at that time. And mostly I'm here talking about Christianity. But after the development of science, after people started to know more of different sciences, they got to this idea that what's the use of religion if I am going to die after all? So let's go for a good life without thinking about religion. Mm-hmm. That even is thought about nowadays. They say that we do not have to go for religion because in our life, we're not going to make use of every moment if we consider religion. If we consider religion, we're going to be so depressed. Our life is going to be so dull, and we're going to have nothing to please ourselves with. Now, I would ask your thoughts upon that after a short break. So, dear listeners, I hope you're not tired. Stay tuned. This is just a cliffhanger. Once more, welcome back to another episode of Back to Reality. In here, I have Bita and Zainab, and they're helping me with today's discussion. So, Zainab, I was just telling that religion sounds so depressing to many people. Is it really like so?
For me, it is not like that at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there has been some periods in my life personally, I'm talking about my personal experience, when I forgot God and I forgot religion and decided to handle my problems without considering God, you know, and the
so you had the a results time of secularization.
Were yes, the results were just miserable,
disastrous.
And, yes, and on the contrary, there were some situations where I considered God and what He wanted me to do. And what came out for me was the peace, the salvation, and even in some cases. So, Asma, I think that requires a wide range of answers. There are lots of criteria that have influence on what people feel about certain things. And definitely, at least for me, religion is the thing that makes you feel better in case you make use of a good religion, good advices, and in case you submit yourself to Allah.
Yes, true religion, yes. And submitting yourself to all the rules of that religion.
And in case you do all these, definitely the consequence would be in your favor. Yeah. I promise you.
Yeah, of course. So, Bita, shall you please tell me your ideas upon
that? Of course. You know, the thing is, I think it is not the problem of the religion that people think in this way. The problem is the way people look at their religion, you know. Mm-hmm. We are defining something that as the way we want to do it, you know. And human being is something that wants to be free, mm-hmm. and just wants to fly freely in this world and do whatever they want to do. And for just doing this, they need approval from other people. And just for receiving this improvement, they will do anything. And one of these things is defining something in a way that will just make the things they do accepted for other people.
Yeah, that's very true.
And because of the thing, they're thinking like that religion is something that tells you what to do. Always what to do. Order you to do this, order you to do that. Exactly. And this is the point why people just want to resist the fact that religion is not something that will limit you. Mm-hmm. It's something that grow you.
Yeah.
Okay. And because of this point, I think we have to change our way of thinking and way of looking at other things, especially this religion. As you know, people around the world have many different kinds of religions. But, you know, this is not the topic, actually, because in every religion, there are some morals that somehow are common. And because of this point, people are hating to be limited. They want to do sins because, they think that, okay, what is the reason why I have to be limited? So I have to ignore it.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Bita. Thank
welcome.
You for your nice contributions. I actually made use of whatever you said. It was so fruitful. I hope the audience have the same feeling. Thank you, dear listeners. I hope you enjoyed today's episode of Back to Reality. May Allah protect you and shower you with His blessings. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah.
يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي let the ummah rise again let us see daylight again once again
Sacred Defense Week. September 22nd, the day in which the Iraqi-imposed war on Iran started in 1980, has been designated as the start of the Sacred Defense Week in the Islamic Republic of Iran. A week which ends on 28th of September, please stay with us for a special program on the occasion of the Sacred Defense Week, from 22nd to 28th of September. On 22nd of September 1980, the Ba'athist regime of Iraq, headed by the dictator Saddam Hussein, started a fully-fledged war against the nascent and newly formed Islamic Republic of Iran. The Islamic Republic was just over a year old at the time, and the dictator Saddam declared war on Iran by appearing live on Iraqi national television and tearing up a copy of the 1975 Algiers Accord, a key peace agreement between Tehran and Baghdad. Thus, the eight-year Ba'athist military aggression against the Islamic Republic of Iran had started. Let us first of all take a look at the history of the 1975 Algiers Accord. On 6th of March 1975, Tehran and Baghdad took a crucial step to end several years of border disputes and border skirmishes, which had marred relations between the two countries. Even though the accord itself and all of its addenda and associated memoranda of understandings were signed in Baghdad, the accord came to be known as the Algiers Accord, since the president of Algeria at the time, Houari Boumediene, and other senior officials of Algeria had acted as mediators and conciliators. However, the Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein tore up the agreement and attacked Iran on 22nd of September 1980, initiating a costly 8-year war. The war was imposed on Iran under circumstances where the arrogant powers, particularly the United States, had placed Tehran under a lot of pressure, and Iran's armed forces were still in disarray, still recovering from the unavoidable turmoil of the revolution. Using Saddam and his army as their tool, the arrogant powers were hoping to wipe out the Islamic Republic. But the brave Iranian nation, with its absolute faith in Islam and unflinching determination, proved them wrong, scuppering all of their calculations and all of their plans, and leaving behind some formidable achievements, such as its unique culture of jihad and self-sacrifice and staunch resistance. Thus, as the Islamic Revolution triumphed under the leadership of Imam Khomeini, may his soul rest in peace, so it was that under his leadership, Islamic Iran triumphed in the 8-year imposed war. For the first time in the past 200 years, Iran had successfully resisted an invasion, driven back the invaders, had not lost even an inch of territory, and had achieved all of this without any help from the outside world. The late Imam Khomeini, may his soul rest in peace, had remarked, "We unveiled the true face of the colonialists and the arrogant powers during the imposed war. We recognize who were our friends and who were our enemies. During the war, we came to the conclusion that it was essential to stand on our own feet and not rely on others. And we shattered the image and the prestige of the two superpowers from the East and the West." The truth is, the 8 years of sacred defense brought with it some very valuable and lasting legacies for both Islamic Iran and the wider Islamic world. These legacies include growing self-confidence and self-belief, unwavering belief and faith in religion, the flourishing of Iran's talents and creativity, strengthening of national unity, more social cohesion, the growing authority and power of the Islamic Republic, Iran's cherished independence, becoming a role model for other nations to follow, and helping to awaken the Islamic world. The Islamic Republic of Iran has also been extremely successful in manufacturing a formidable range of military hardware, weapon systems, and ballistic missiles, giving the country considerable deterrence capabilities. Some of these ballistic missiles include the Shahab, the Fateh, the Qiyam, the Ahmad, the Sajil, the Khurramshahr, the Sful, Fateh Mubin, and Rad 500 ballistic missile. The military website 1945, in a well-known analysis, has concluded that the Islamic Republic of Iran has the most extensive, most effective, modern and capable ballistic missile arsenal in the West Asia region, giving Iran a formidable deterrence capability and power. Commenting on the formation of a wide front consisting of both the East and the West against the Islamic Republic of Iran during the 8 years of imposed war, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said, "The main intent of this wide-ranging front was to create internal problems for the Islamic Republic of Iran, to weaken this country, and ultimately to destroy this country. But the great Iranian nation, despite all the difficulties and shortages at the time, successfully resisted this wide-ranging front and emerged with its head held high and with flying colors."
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
When it comes to Iran and the UN General Assembly this year, one of the questions asked was whether the Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi would meet and talk with the U.S. President Joe Biden. The answer was pretty clear.
You're off to New York. You're going to speak at the United Nations. You know, President Biden is going to be there. Are you open to a meeting with President Biden, a face-to-face?
No, I don't think that such a meeting would happen.
I don't believe having a meeting or talk with him will be beneficial.
But this issue should not be the focus, because Iran's presence at this year's assembly means so much more than just whether Raisi will meet Biden or not. So much has changed since Ebrahim Raisi spoke at last year's UNGA.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, Iran is the land of culture and civilization.
The transformation of Iran from just a year ago to the current Islamic Republic today is quite remarkable, especially on the international arena. But how has Iran changed? For example, Ebrahim Raisi has been able to turn the table when it comes to harsh and cruel U.S. bilateral sanctions. His administration has turned Iran's economy around, with Iran's GDP and foreign trade to have increased. No easy task when it comes to it being executed. Another example, he kept true to his word and did not link Iran's economic challenges or progress to the JCPOA revival or sanctions removal talks. That has had an impact on an international level, since he showed in action that economic problems could be solved without a deal with the U.S. and some Western countries. Furthermore, when it comes to negotiations, Iran is not negotiating from a weak economic position. An economy that is rebounding strongly, it has beaten the maximum pressure campaign that the U.S. exerted on it. The important achievements of this administration can be seen here. They have elevated Iran's standing not only domestically, but also on the world stage. And the reason why this is important is because it flies smack in the face of U.S. and Western sanctions, showing how Iran can withstand these unilateral coercive measures and progress at the same time. This is what the UN Charter, Article 2, states. All members shall settle their international disputes by peaceful means, in such a manner that international peace and security and justice are not endangered. A comparative look between Iran versus the U.S. makes it glaringly clear that the U.S. is acting in the opposite direction of this charter. It has indeed taken a militaristic approach when it comes to making a choice between war and peace. It is worth noting that to this day, Iran has not invaded any country or indeed started a war in more than two centuries, something that the U.S. cannot claim. As a matter of fact, recently Iran may have set a new record for hosting foreign dignitaries. In a matter of 1 week, not a day went by when a high-ranking official was not in Iran, which included figures like the Russian President Vladimir Putin and the Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and the likes. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi will be making his presence coming off fresh from his appearance at the SCO, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization Summit. This is important, since Iran has become a permanent member of this organization. And the reason for this importance is, unlike claims made by the U.S. and the West, Iran is an important fixture on the world stage.
In recent years, political and economic multilateralism has come under serious threat. The U.S. government is trying to impose its demands and domestic law on the international system and sovereign countries through outright bullying and coercion. Washington's unilateralism is undoubtedly aimed at hampering independent countries' progress.
The SCO is the world's largest regional organization, covering approximately 60% of the area of Eurasia, 40% of the world population, and more than 30% of the global GDP. Yet a recent incident took place that did not get much coverage, but it displayed how the Islamic Republic has peaceful intentions when it comes to conflicts and can act as a mediator. It had to do with the Ukraine conflict. The Iranian Foreign Minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, delivered a European peace initiative on Ukraine to Russia, in which Iran said it had received the proposal from an anonymous European leader. This squarely pits Iran's peaceful intentions against the U.S. warmongering policy when it comes to Ukraine. So, when Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi takes the podium, representing Iran and his peaceful intentions, like its peaceful nuclear program, it is showing how Iran deserves the respect that it is entitled to, not the sanctions and embargoes imposed by the West and the U.S. Oil and gas, two commodities that have been at the center of news for months now, mainly due to the conflict in Ukraine. One of the criticisms leveled against these oil and gas giants are the record profits that they are raking in.
It is immoral for oil and gas companies to be making record profits from this energy crisis on the back of the poorest people and communities and at a massive cost to the climate.
A bombshell report, however, is putting the spotlight more on these oil companies, but for the wrong reasons. Like this headline, criticism intensifies after big oil admits gaslighting public over green aims, which goes on to say, fury as explosive files reveal largest oil companies contradicted public statements and wished bedbugs upon critical activists like this one.
And here today, we're going to be out demanding that the City of London, which is responsible or oversees about 15% of fossil fuel funding, could actually very, very rapidly, you know, get this source of finance switched off and move towards a green economy.
Here are the opening statements of the Oversight Committee.
Today we are holding our third hearing in the committee's investigation into the fossil fuel industry's decades-long climate disinformation and greenwashing campaigns.
Big oil, namely ExxonMobil, Chevron, Shell, and BP, are at the center of controversy again and yet again, lying about keeping in line with climate change restrictions.
But these executives refused to commit to real changes.
What kind of lies? Here's one example.
But it is more than having to change. We want to change. We want to change because it's the right thing for the world, and it's a tremendous business opportunity for BP.
It was not too long ago when these headlines and pictures were plastered on the front pages of newspapers around the world. Climate change alarm, code red for humanity. Yet these alarm bells fail to stop these big oil companies from advancing their agenda, making money at the expense of people for their shareholders. While these companies are making record profits, it is worth noting the economic costs of climate change. The global cost of adapting to the climate impacts is expected to grow $140 to $300 billion per year by the year 2030 and $280 to $500 billion per year by the year 2050. To get the full impact of what these energy conglomerates are doing, the bare facts need to be known. According to a report published by the Carbon Majors Database in 2017, just 100 of them have been the source of more than 70% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions since the year 1988. If fossil fuels continue to be extracted at the same rate over the next 28 years as they were between 1988 and 2017, global temperatures would rise by 4 degrees Celsius by the end of the century. What is shocking is that these large corporations, like Exxon, knew about climate change almost 50 years ago. In 2015, it was revealed that Exxon understood the science before it became a public issue. It was called the Climate Deception Dossiers.
The reality of global warming began making front-page headlines nearly 30 years ago. That's when the world's largest fossil fuel companies launched a three-decade campaign to deceive the public and delay action on climate change.
The worst part about these findings was that ExxonMobil spent millions of dollars to promote misinformation about the issue. The goal? To sow doubt about climate change. Let that sink in. Because these dossiers revealed that the coalition of fossil fuel companies had launched a big communications effort to sow doubt. Their motto, victory will be achieved when the average person is uncertain about climate science. Then in 2019, it was reported that major global firms were accused of concealing their environmental impact. This included more than 700 companies like Facebook, Amazon, Tesco, and here we go again, ExxonMobil. Accused of lacking transparency over things like water shortages and deforestation. How these non-oil and gas companies do this is that they do what's called greenwashing, conveying a false impression that one's products are environmentally friendly or sound, when in essence they are not. And here are some of the companies that are guilty of this. Famous brands known the world over, claiming that they have gone green, but in essence they have not. Whether it was the Paris Climate Accord or COP26.
And we arrive at what I believe is the moment of truth.
Or John Kerry.
It is time to come together for future generations in ways that none of us really ever thought we might have an opportunity to do.
All of that appears to be on the shelf for now. With a lack of energy resources, European countries and the U.S. are scrambling to fill the shortages, even if it includes resorting to big CO2 emitters like fossil fuels. On the surface, this is legislation that the U.S. is passing through Congress to, in short, stop African countries from associating with Russia, especially when it comes to business activities. But looking deeper, this is what many call the U.S. bullying other countries into submission. That is how the South African president is viewing this, urging the U.S. to not punish African nations by pressuring them to cut ties with Moscow. Cyril Ramaphosa realizes the dangers behind this legislation. You said that this measure will harm Africa and marginalize the continent. We should not be told by anyone who we can associate with. When it comes to Russia, many African countries feel the same. For example, when a UN voting took place for sanctions to be imposed on Russia, 17 African countries abstained from the UN vote. The U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, had to come out and defend U.S. interests in Africa, stating that U.S. intentions are not to dictate what African nations should do.
Too often, African nations have been treated as instruments of other nations' progress rather than the authors of their own. Time and again, they have been told to pick a side in great power contests that feel far removed from daily struggles of their people. The United States will not dictate Africa's choices. Neither should anyone else.
The source of this aggressive U.S. legislation dates back years ago. During the tenure of the former U.S. President Donald Trump, the U.S. unveiled a new Africa policy to counter what it called predatory Russia and China. This was unveiled by the former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton, who said that the U.S. was losing ground to China and Russia.
The predatory practices pursued by China and Russia stunt economic growth in Africa, threaten the financial independence of African nations, inhibit opportunities for U.S. investment, interfere with U.S. military operations, and pose a significant threat to U.S. national security interests.
Yet Bolton was not forthright in the U.S. policy on Africa. He failed to mention that the U.S. had limited resources to compete with the tens of billions of dollars that China was pouring into Africa. And on the predatory practices of China and Russia, that set up debt traps, that just didn't hold ground. Take this piece of news, the fact that China canceled 23 loans to African countries. This silenced the critics that accused Beijing of practicing debt trap diplomacy, that it deliberately lent money to countries that it knows cannot repay the money, with the goal of increasing its political leverage. Meanwhile, the U.S. has fallen out of favor with many African countries. One survey found that 76% of young Africans named China as the foreign power with a positive influence on their lives. When it comes to Russia, the U.S. has accused it of selling arms in exchange for votes at the U.N. Those votes, he added, helped keep strongmen in power, undermined peace and security, and ran counter to the best interests of the African people. Well, if that is the case, then what about the U.S. keeping strongmen in power in monarchies in the Persian Gulf, regimes like Saudi Arabia or Bahrain?
They're all international institutions.
South Africa's foreign minister, Naledi Pandor, holds the same view as the South African president when it comes to Russia. She referenced the Soviet Union's championing of anti-apartheid forces, compared with Western cooperation with South Africa's former white supremacist regime. The U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, had to come out and defend U.S. interests in Africa, stating that U.S. intentions are not to dictate what African nations should do.
What we seek most of all is a true partnership between the United States and Africa. We don't want an imbalanced or transactional relationship. And our commitment to a stronger partnership with Africa is not about trying to outdo anyone else.
Successive U.S. administrations have tried to penetrate the African political and economic landscape, but it looks like their efforts have not succeeded, lagging one step behind other powers like China and Russia. The Ukraine conflict is clear proof of that. This is one of the occasions that many nations have been reluctant to embrace the West in its campaign to pressure Moscow. But that is not the only time that a considerable portion of an entire continent does not give importance to U.S. pressure. Recently, snubs from key leaders at the Summit of the Americas revealed U.S. President Joe Biden's struggle to assert U.S. leadership in his neighborhood. The issue of U.S. leadership being questioned begs the question, where else is the U.S. leadership under doubt? From Latin America to Africa to West Asia, all the way to Asia and China in particular, the U.S. is losing support from countries around the world. That is why the phrase, the U.S. losing its superpower status, continues to reverberate in many countries. But perhaps one of the tools that the U.S. uses, which has had a strong backlash, making it fall out of favor with many countries, is the use of sanctions and the use of the dollar as a weapon. Many countries view this as a form of bullying for countries to follow U.S. foreign policy, which is probably why the South African president has said, we should not be told by anyone who we can associate with. It was a massacre that was unprecedented, and it highlighted how private U.S. military contractors felt that they were above the law. 15 years ago, these military contractors shot and killed 17 Iraqis, including two children. The massacre, which became known as the Nisour Square Massacre, highlighted what can go wrong when private military contractors are used, especially when it comes to accountability.
We strive for perfection. We try to drive towards the highest standards, but the fog of war and accidents and the bad guys just have to get lucky once.
The U.S. used private military contractors heavily in Iraq and in Afghanistan. Now the new theater of war is Ukraine. Here is an ad for hiring these contractors. Wanted, multilingual former soldiers willing to covertly head into Ukraine for the handsome sum of up to $2,000 per day. Yes, demand is soaring, and there are plenty of people who are signing up. But what are they called? Contractors? Volunteers? Mercenaries? Or paid security workers? Obviously, some are former soldiers with the ability to fight and kill. This leaves plenty of room for mistakes, meaning civilian casualties. Remember when Ukraine's president made this announcement? Zelensky reveals number of foreign volunteers for Ukraine, the first of some 16,000 fighters to have already arrived, the Ukrainian president said. He further added, Ukraine continues to receive weaponry on a daily basis from our partners, from real friends. The weapons are more and more powerful every day. The very same weapons that are given to these volunteers. So far, the number of so-called volunteers to have joined the Ukrainian armed forces could be as high as 20,000, a figure that could even exceed that. The demographics of these fighters are varied. In all, fighters from Eastern Europe and former Soviet republics constitute the majority of fighters. In terms of Western countries, the greatest number of foreign fighters include the U.S., U.K., Canada, Germany, France, and even some that are coming from Japan. When it comes to the U.S. private military contractors, the one that stands out is Academy, formerly known as Blackwater. Reports have pointed to its involvement in Ukraine. First, reports emerged in July 2021 that Blackwater founder Eric Prince had plans to create a $10 billion private army in Ukraine. His plans included a private army staff by former Ukrainian combat veterans. However, what is not widely reported was that Academy was involved in Ukraine already since the year 2014. Hundreds of these mercenaries were operating in the countries east and south, but the U.S. has denied these claims. But other Western countries are open in their admission of foreign fighters fighting in Ukraine. Take Germany, for example. Germany's Foreign Office tweet is very telling here. Reports on death sentences against foreign nationals serving in Ukraine's armed forces are shocking. As combatants, they are prisoners of war, entitled to special protections under the Geneva Convention. The UK's involvement has been heavy when it comes to foreign fighters. In June, it was reported how the UK has training centers set up for Ukrainian recruits to train soldiers sent by Kiev, including women, for urban combat. The target for the number of people that the UK can train, 10,000 soldiers every 3 months. Whether they are private military contractors, volunteers, or whatever name they are called, they're fueling the flames of war. It should be mentioned that Russia is also complicit in its use of contractors or mercenaries as well, as it has been reported. The extent and the number, however, is not known. Let's not forget, it wasn't too long ago that the armed groups in Syria were getting help from America, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Turkey. And a source of training for the armed gangs was the notorious U.S. private security firm formerly known as Blackwater. Security circles have long reported that it was sending mercenaries from Iraq into Syria, something which the U.S. stands accused of until this day. Ukraine is becoming eerily similar to Syria, thanks to the U.S. and its European partners, who are keen to make sure that this war continues, from the massive military aid to manpower in the form of these contractors. Pumping Ukraine with weapons has become the main trend for the U.S., leading the Europeans down the same path. So high the volume of these weapons that Ukrainian illegal arms trafficking has become a terrorist threat at an international level. This is just another outcome of the wrong and deadly U.S. foreign policy, in which many Iraqis witnessed 15 years ago, as was the case in the Nusayr Square massacre.
بسم ربك الذي خلق
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم يا أيها المزمل قم الليل إلا قليلا نصفه
أو انقص منه قليلا أو زد عليه ورتل القرآن ترتيلا
قد دعوتك ربي بقرآني جنبني حراني
Let's recite the Quran.
ناجيتك أرجو غفرانك يا من ينجينا إحسان ودعوتك ربي بقرآني
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطاهرين
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد
السلام عليكم and welcome to Let's Recite the Quran Kareem, a series of Quranic sessions held by IRIB English Radio in cooperation with Sevier International Schools Network. I really welcome you all and respected brothers and sisters. In this session, inshallah, again, we're going to work on some of the verses of the Quran Kareem from Surah Al-Baqarah. So, Ali Nasir and Fawad Haider, if you're ready, let's recite a salawat and start our class.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad
wa ajil faraj. Okay, today I will work on verse number 6 of Surah Al-Baqarah, Inna alladhina kafaru, and up to verse number 10, Fi qulubihim maradun. Okay, inshallah, let's listen to these verses of the Quran Kareem.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Inna alladhina kafaru sawa'un alayhim a'anzartahum قَتَمَ اللَّهُ عَلَى قُلُوبِهِمْ وَعَلَى سَمْعِهِمْ وَعَلَى أَبْصَارِهِمْ غِشَاوَةٌ وَلَهُمْ عَذَابٌ عَظِيمٌ
Okay, great. Alhamdulillah, nice recitation. So, في قلوبهم مرضون. In the next ayah, Allah Almighty says that in their hearts, there is a disease. Marad. Okay? Marad. What kind of marad? The disease of kufr. Okay? Non-believing. So, فزادهم الله مرضا. Allah Almighty is increasing. Okay? May Allah Almighty increase their marad. Okay? Stay there. Okay? Die of your kufr. Okay? وَلَهُمْ عَذَابٌ أَلِيمٌ. And there is like a painful punishment for them because of their lies. They used to tell to the Prophet, we believe in you, but when the Prophet is not there, when the Prophet is out of the city, they were making plots against the Prophet, okay? They were trying to plan to kind of somehow kill the Prophet, okay? In the early Islam. Nowadays as well, it's like this. So, may inshallah Allah Almighty help us stay on the away on the path of guidance, okay? Inshallah, these levels of explanations that we have interpretations, okay? This is like for adults and for youngsters, okay? So inshallah, our friends who are looking for better explanations and more explanations, okay? They can refer to the interpretations of the scholars, okay? Who have interpreted the Quran Kareem. For example, Tafsir al-Namuna, okay, Tafsir al-Mizan, Tafsir, any other Tafasir, okay, books, okay, they can refer, inshallah. So, the first important point in this ayah is the tashdid on the letter Mim. Fi qulubihim marab. Fi qulubihim, Mim sakin, plus Mim. So, Mim mushaddad, yes? We joined them, idgham, with gunnah. So two counts. Mim mushaddad with two counts. Gunna sound, right? Right?
Yes.
And before that, there is a yamad. Sometimes students recite this way. Fi qulubihim. Fi qulubihim. They do not stretch the sound of fa. While it's harf al-mad. We have harf al-mad. Yeah. Fi qulubihim. Not fi qulubihim. Okay? في قلوبهم يا مدي يس في قلوبهم في قلوبهم if you say and not pronounce the يا now pronounce the wow it's wrong مرض the next important point so في قلوبهم مرض recite it once
في قلوبهم مرض.
Some of the students pronounce qaf like the letter qaf. If you change them, it's again wrong, okay? في قلوبهم. We have some students. I had some students, okay? They were pronouncing this way. They were English speakers because qaf is a little difficult for them. They do not have it in English. That's why it might be difficult for them. So they need to practice a lot, okay? في قلوبهم. If, brothers and sisters listening to us, if you have this problem, I can help you right now. Listen carefully. في قلوبهم. The letter قاف. Say غين. غين. Stop there. When you're saying غا, make a pause there. Or when you're gargling. Just stop once there. Yeah?
Yes.
Practice it once. Make a pause. There. Sudden pause, okay? Just a sudden pause. Make a pause. Yes, yes. Both of you. One, two. Help our brothers. Those have problem with this letter. Yeah. Or when someone is choked, okay? They're choked. Yeah, this way. So that's the sound of qaf, or that the crew sound, qar, qar, okay? That is the sound of qaf. So it's easy. It's not difficult, so if you practice, you can fix it. So it's different from the letter qaf, okay?
Yes.
Qaf, kaf. في قلوبهم مرض. Dad has a tanween dhamma on the top, fawad. And then we have fa. What rule is applied? Tanween plus fa? Idhar. Is he right?
Ikhfa.
Ikhfa. That's correct. Ikhfa. Why? Because Fa is not from throne letters, and neither it is from Yarmun letters. And also, it's not from Iqlab letters. Iqlab letters, not Qutbijat. Qutbijat doesn't have anything to do with Tanween and Nun Sakin. Iqlab letter. Iqlab letter. Uh-huh. Yes, one letter. The letter Ba. Okay. Now, we have to hide the sound of Tanween here. في قلوبهم مرض فزادهم الله مرضا مرض فزادهم الله recite it مرض فزاد
مرض فزاد
not meme sound just hide the sound of noon close your mouth then the sound of noon gets
مرض
مرض مرض alright علي ناصر
مرض فزادهم الله
فا is a light letter not like a heavy letter مرض no مرض
مرض
yeah like making a smiley face مرض
مرض فزادهم
look at my lips مرض
مرض
As if you think of like the gate of a garage, okay? It's just coming down and getting closed. Maradun. Garage, okay?
Maradun.
It's closed. Yeah. Maradun. Your lips, okay? Maradun. Dun. Close.
Like it's from a circular shape.
It no, comes... no, not a circular. Yeah, from a circular shape goes to a straight base, a straight shape, okay? Maradun. It's easy. Go on. Maradun.
Maradun.
Have you ever played hide and seek game?
Yes.
Hide the noon sound.
Maradun.
Fazadahum. That's great.
Maradun.
Practice it, inshallah, okay?
قلب بالحق تعلق وبغار حراء تألق يبكي يسأل خالقه فأتاه الوحي فأشرق اقرأ اقرأ
Let's recite the Quran
اقرأ بسم ربك الذي خلق
فزادهم الله The word Allah, the letter lam in the word Allah is heavy. Why? Because there is
Fatha.
A dhamma sound before the word Allah. Okay, Fawad is laughing at you because you got a mistake here. So, maradun fazadahum Allah. Yeah? Mullah. Okay. So, marada, marada. A dot is a heavy letter, and also it has a tanwin fatha. So, whenever we stop on a word ending with tanwin fatha will be changed to? Okay, it changes to?
Alif.
Alif, okay. Alif mad. Not alif simple mad, alif.
Yeah, alif. Alif mad.
So, marada with two counts. But here also we have like, it is the natural mad, but we have, we had a rule that if you stop, natural mat will be changed to a longer mat.
Yes.
So, let's recite this way. في قلوبهم مرض فزادهم الله مرضا. Longer mat. Go on.
Yes.
في قلوبهم مرض فزادهم الله مرضا.
أحسن أحسن. So, وَلَهُمْ عَذَابٌ أَلِيمٌ Let's take a look at this ayah. I told you, أَلِيمٌ If Hamza is pronounced عَيْن in the preposition, I told you.
Yes.
The meaning changes. Fawad, be careful. Your عَيْن is not fixed.
Here is فَتَنَا.
Fix your عَيْن pronunciation, okay?
For me, here is فَتَنَا, Hamza.
No, no. Yeah.
No, when there is فَتَ, I think it's فَتَ.
So you That's should think.
Ah, yes. You don't think like that, okay? The ayn, no, the letter. The letter will have the
when
sound.
When there's Hamza, it. The Hamza there, I think.
Oh, like, I'm saying, a, I'm telling you. Don't think. Like, I'm telling you. I'm telling you.
When
don't
I think there's Fatah, I'm like, yeah, no so, ayn.
Yeah, I'm telling you, don't think. Look carefully. Believe it's not only a Fatah. There is a letter as well having a Fatah. Read that Fatah, read that letter with Fatah. Okay. So let's finish this ayah, and inshallah, we don't have much time. We will end this session. So, وَلَهُمْ عَذَابٌ أَلِيمٌ بُن تَنْوِين فَتْ تَنْوِين ضَمَّ then Hamza throat letters. What rule is applied?
إظهار
no rule will be applied actually. Yes, إظهار. Yes. إظهار as if it's no rule. Yes. عَذَابٌ أَلِيمٌ تَنْوِين ضَمَّ again plus ميم plus ba sorry. إقلاب. You change that tanween sound to a half meme. بما كانوا يكذبون. That's all. Let's recite this ayah and repeat after me.
في قلوبهم مرض فزادهم الله مرضا.
في قلوبهم مرض فزادهم الله مرضا
ولهم عذاب أليم بما كانوا يكذبون
ولهم عذاب أليم بما كانوا يكذبون
أحسن. I want to give you one point, and that is, have you memorized these previous verses that we have practiced?
No.
I have memorized. So I want you to practice, okay, as we are reciting at home, okay, during, we don't have class, so practice them and memorize them. It's easy. I've memorized this ayah, so inshallah, I want you to memorize. Thank you so much. That was all about this ayah from us, okay, practical tajweed rules. See you inshallah in the coming session. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen wa sallallahu ala Muhammad wa alihi al-tahiri.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وأجل فرج
Let's recite the Quran, a joint production of IRIB English Radio and Xavier International Schools.
ذكر وموعظة ونور فيه شفاء للصدور وشفيعنا يوم النشور آياته تروي المدى وصفاته نبع الهدى نرقى الجنان بحبه لن تستقيم حياتنا إلا به هو القرآن والفرقان إليه تنصت الأكوان وفيه تعطر الآذان والقرآن
IRIB English Radio